the October Country. That country where it's always turning late in the year. That country where the hills are fog and the rivers are mist. Where noons go quickly, dusks and twilights linger, and midnights stay. That country composed in the main of cellars, subcellars, coal bins, closets, attics, and pantries, all faced away from the sun. That country whose people are autumn people, thinking only autumn thoughts. Whose people passing at night on the empty walks sound like rain. That was Ray Bradbury's description of the autumn people, the residents of the October Country. Of course, when autumn people dream, they dream October dreams. Welcome to Houston Taping for the Blind's Halloween special. I'm your host, Robert Schuller. A few years ago, Richard Chizmar and Robert Morish put together a collection of short stories, Halloween facts, and autumn remembrances. In a celebration of Halloween, they aptly entitled October Dreams. They dedicated it to Ray Bradbury, whom they dubbed the October Dreamer Extraordinaire. In today's show, we'll hear the favorite Halloween memories of several contemporary writers of horror, science fiction, and fantasy, all autumn people for certain. And as I introduce each storyteller, I'll share with you selections from Paula Guran's A Short History of Halloween. So sit back, relax, and enjoy October Dreams. Festivals emphasizing the supernatural and death are common in almost all cultures. Modern Halloween is at least influenced by and probably originated with the ancient Celtic festival of Samhain. For the Celts, the period we now consider the end of October and start of November was a time of preparation, festival, and plenty before the coming of the long winter. Although the bounty of nature and the natural change of seasons were important aspects of Samhain, it was also a festival of the supernatural. Samhain was the turning point of the year for a people who believed that even minor turning points, the change from one day to the next, a meeting of sea and shore, were magical. The turning of the year was the most powerful and sacred of such junctures. In her favorite Halloween memory, writer Elizabeth Engstrom shares with us a major turning point in her life and the importance Halloween played in that. A Moonlit Night with Rats is told to us by Marcy Corder.
I grew up tortured, literally. The only girl with five older brothers, I was alternately experimented upon, humiliated, and continually put in harm's way. I was also cherished and protected as only five big brothers can do. As a result, I grew up hoydenish. I envied my brothers' physical prowess, their lithe grace, the way they handled snakes, guns, and beer. I tried to be just like them, but I wasn't. I was a girl, plump, uncoordinated, easily scared, not at all athletic. When we were little, my mother always made them take me with them. I loved it. They hated having a little sister tag along, and they tortured me for it. I loved that, too, in a way. The Halloween when I was 13, too old for trick-or-treating, too young for the beer busts, two of my brothers, the two closest to my age, the two most vicious, got together with two of their friends in our backyard. I was inside getting the candy ready for the neighborhood kids, looking out the patio doors at them with envy as they lounged around on the lawn furniture in their sweatshirts and jeans. I had budding breasts and lank hair and was so self-conscious I didn't even want to look at those brothers because they were always teasing me and doing it in front of their friends. Just at twilight, as the doorbell began to ring and our little dog barked every time as if it were a fresh surprise, Rob, my 15-year-old brother, came in and asked me if I wanted to go out with him that night. Suspicious, I asked, "Where?" "To the dump," he said, "to shoot rats." "With them?" I asked, pointing at his friends who were watching us through the window. "Yeah," Rob said. "Van wanted me to invite you." "Why?" Rob shrugged. "Figure it out." Did Van like me? I was staggered by the thought and hammered by the implications. "Sure," I said, "I'll go." I looked outside and Van smiled at me. It didn't seem so bad. I grabbed my jacket and handed the bowl of candy to my mom. "I'm going out with Rob and Christian," I said, then didn't wait for her questions or her protests. I'd learned how to handle the parents by watching the brothers. Van opened the back door of Mike's beat-up black Chevy for me and hopped in next to me. Rob got in the other side, and my older brother Christian got in front with Mike, and we took off. We had always gone to the dump when we were kids. It was within bike riding distance, and it had awesome scavenging potentials. One time I found a perfect antique oil lamp, but the boys broke the glass. One time they came home with a shoebox full of green snakes, and they smuggled it past Mom into the basement. The next day the box was empty, and they threatened me with death if I told. I never did. I hadn't been to the dump in years. It was full dark by the time we parked, and Mike handed around a six-pack of Foster's. I sat quietly in the back, feeling the heat of Van's body next to me, listening to their easy laughter and smelling their testosterone. I drank the beer, which tasted mighty fine, but it wasn't long before the inevitable happened. I had to pee. I waited until the squirming point, hoping that one of the other boys would have to go first, and instead of listening to them talk and laugh, I concentrated on how I would go about the act. If I tried to go too far from the car, they'd pull around and shine the headlights on me, or something equally as humiliating. Eventually, I figured it out. I nudged Rob and had him let me out, and I pulled a tissue from my jeans and squatted right at the rear of the car, my hand on the trunk. I figured I'd be safe there, but I was wrong. No sooner had I got my pants down than the car started up, and gravel spit at me, and they were off, their laughter ringing in my ears like demon shouts from hell. Van didn't really like me, I realized. This would be just a good Halloween prank. Dump the kid's sister at the dump. I finished peeing and then used the tissue to blow my nose. I found an old mattress to sit on while I weighed my options. I'd wait for them until I didn't want to wait anymore, and then I'd walk home. It wasn't that far. But my heart was broken, so I sat on that old mattress and cried for a while first. They didn't come back. Of course they didn't come back, and I sat there until I began to like it. The dump had a certain majesty in the Halloween moonlight. During the day, the place was hot, it stank, and was filled with noisy, screeching seagulls. But at night, on this night, I could barely smell it, and its strange landscape shone silvery in the moonlight. I could see the rats, big as beavers, rustling through the plastic sacks. I stomped my feet at them if they got too close, and once they found out that I moved, they seemed content to leave me alone. I spent a lot of time sitting on that nasty old mattress until long after I was sure the little ghosts and goblins had finished ringing the doorbell and making Chica bark. I thought about my family, my friends, my brothers and their friends. I thought about my approaching womanhood and realized that I could decide what kind of woman I would be and that the options were endless. I didn't have to be a tomboy. I didn't have to be ashamed of my breasts or my klutzy ways. I didn't have to be able to jump over barbed wire fences. I didn't have to pretend delight in the killing of little furry things. I could try a few things like earrings and lipstick and things that intrigued me but which also had intimidated me. That girly stuff seemed to come so easy to some. When I sat down on that mattress, I was the tortured plaything of a bunch of bullies. And when I stood up, I felt as though my life had become my own. I felt adventurous in a completely different way. And when I heard footsteps on the road and I identified the silhouette as Van's, I didn't hide and throw things at him, as was my first impulse. Instead, I stood up and walked toward him. He had left the others in the woods and walked all the way back to the dump to see if I was all right. By the time we reached my house, he was holding my hand, and I felt poised on the brink of self. My personal year begins and ends on Halloween. That is when I make my New Year's resolutions. That is the season when I take risks and plan for the future. I first met my husband on Halloween. It's also the day I send greeting cards to my wonderful brothers, now that they're grown, and sit for a few minutes every year and wonder, whatever happened to Van? I wonder also if he has a special affinity for that day as well, because as sure as I grew up that night surrounded by rats, so did he.
The farther we've gotten from the magic and mystery of our past, the more we've come to need Halloween. It's a festival of fantasy, a celebration of otherness, the one time each year when the mundane is overturned in favor of the bizarre, and anyone can become anyone or anything they wish. At its core, Halloween is a chance to confront our most primal fear, death, an attempt to control it or, at the very least, mock it. Ancient beliefs, religious meanings, a multitude of ethnic heritages, diverse occult traditions, and the continual influence of popular culture have combined to make Halloween a booming commercial industry as well as a beloved holiday. The essentially American holiday is now spreading to other countries. Canadians already celebrate with their neighbors to the south. England, Australia, and Japan are adopting American Halloween activities. In France, Yankee Halloween costumes have become very popular in the last decade. In his favorite Halloween memory, British author Peter Crowther reflects on the changing face of Halloween celebrations in the UK, and what parents can do when their children forget Halloween is about being scared. David Gilmore is our storyteller.
Even here in England, the pretty Halloween stories are increasingly filled with all the usual seasonal goodies. Ghoulish heads, witch hats, ghosts' face flashlights, and, of course, no end of gruesomely gooey candies and chocolate bars to slip into the grasping hands of tiny trick-or-treaters, just like the U.S. But it hasn't always been that way. In fact, as when I was a fresh-faced youngster in short pants, Halloween meant nothing at all for most Brits. I, however, was not what one might call typical of British childhood. Being a 4th of July arrival, I suppose it was inevitable that I would follow U.S. traditions, a situation undoubtedly fueled by my immersing myself in American TV shows and comic books, and, as time went by, in novels and stories written by American writers. Not surprisingly, references to Halloween and Thanksgiving, plus other U.S. holidays and traditions, figured heavily into my greedy intake of words, and it wasn't long before a few careful inquiries revealed the truth. Wow! Monsters and ghouls and witches and werewolves all coming together for one special night of unbridled mayhem. Count me in. Thus, I would spend many a smoky autumn evening with friends, wandering the woodland trails of the park a half mile from my house in the sleepy Yorkshire suburb of Headingley, watching the skies for signs of airborne broomsticks and peering into the thick bushes and trees for just a glimpse of something white or furry-faced, its teeth gleaming. Alas, I didn't see any, although I recall boasting, as did many of my contemporaries, of just such a sighting when school convened the next day. The power of imagination was such that, at least in those simpler times, the other kids believed what I said just as unquestionably as I believed what they said. But my stories were always just a little bit denser and maybe just a little more graphic than those told by my friends, and I guess that was an early indication of what I'd end up doing for a living a few decades down the line. Back then, of course, it was relatively easy to break into the thin veil of universal knowledge and belief, and its detestable cousin, common sense. A lot of kids still believed in Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy way up into their teens, so it was but a small step to accept that, on one special night of the year, the inhabitants of the local cemetery rolled back their soily covers and went for a wander, dark thoughts brooding in their worm-eaten heads. Now, it's not so easy. Kids these days take a lot of convincing about anything at all. And so it was, one Halloween night 13 or 14 years ago, I hatched a plan to change all that, just for one night. Nikki and I have two sons, Oliver and Timothy, 23 and 21 respectively. One of them graduated in graphic design a couple of years ago, and the other graduates as an actor this summer. But 13 or 14 years ago, they weren't quite so self-assured and worldly wise as they are now. We had always celebrated Halloween, if celebrated is the correct word, even when it wasn't fashionable in Britain. There were a couple of stores that used to put out a few cheesy-looking cardboard masks and those slimy plastic spiders, but most stores were busy stocking up on Christmas cards. Now, of course, the Christmas cards come out as soon as August comes to a close. But good props were hard to find. So we, or rather Nikki, used to construct black cloaks and hoods for Ollie and Tim and sent them out trick-or-treating, always hovering in the background to watch them in case the real kid-herding monsters got to them, armed with plastic tubs to collect their spoils, most of which would come from the boy's Nana, my own mother, who lived in an apartment at the top of our house. But that was when the children were really young. By the time adolescence showed signs of creeping up on our sons and the first flush of testosterone began to pump, I needed something better to capture their imaginations, something more real. On this particular Halloween, we had friends staying over. The day itself fell on a Saturday, and it rolled onto a particularly Halloween-y night filled with mist and gloom and a damp cold that seeped through even the thickest clothing to eat right into the marrow of your bones. Our house guests were my oldest friend, Phil. We've been staunch pals since 8 years old, and his wife, Yvonne, and their two kids, Simon and Anna, both around the same age as our two. I'd spoken with Phil beforehand and hatched a fairly demonic plan. I tend to speak with Phil a lot. He's a doctor, and I always seek his advice when I want to kill somebody or to describe any horrible side effects of symptoms of a condition I want to put a character through. It's a hard life being a god. Oh, anyway, Phil had gone for it, and Yvonne, too, though she was a little more circumspect. And the other two adults in the scene had also gone for it, and they'd gone for it in a big way. Sam and Lucy have since moved south, but at the time they lived in Hargate, quite near us. Sam was a big wheel in ICI, and so, like me, with my corporate background in handling communications for the financial services industry, he was no stranger to the gentle art of lying and bullshitting that is so essential to boardroom survival. And Sam and Lucy have two boys, Johnny and Patrick, also around the same age as the other four. The first part of the plan, there were two parts. One of them, the first one, for the consumption of everyone, and the other one known only to the adults. The plan was that we'd all gather Shea Crowther for a family meal, plus spooky videos. But first, Phil, Sam, and I would take the six kids into the woods to look for witches and stuff. There were, inevitably, lots of negative sounds from the kids, all of whom had long overgrown that crap. Hell, they were 10 years old, or getting on that way. But as the day went on and the sky darkened, they kind of warmed to the idea. Like I said, it was starting to turn real nasty out there. So nasty, it was like this was the Halloween night of all to them. The one night in the history of really horrible nights that, if something were to come lumbering out of the graveyard, hell-bent on tearing a kid's head off, then it would be tonight. Thus, as the prearranged time came for our departure, the bravado come board acceptance that had replaced the kid's initial negativity began to dilute a little. So far, so good. Phil and I left my house with our four kids in the back seat, little faces staring out of the windows at the drizzle and the mist, and watching every figure marching forward bent against the elements to make sure they didn't turn and glare at them with red-rimmed eyes, or maybe reach out a clawed hand at the car door while we were waiting at traffic signals. We arrived at Sam's place to find Sam and Lucy embroiled in a bit of an argument, a very well-rehearsed argument, with Patrick and Johnny watching with that nervousness all kids develop when they see their parents having a disagreement. Lucy was saying that she didn't want us to take the kids out. It's dangerous out there, she told him. Sam, a true thespian, scoffed. Scoff, scoff. At this, and asked her to elaborate on what she was talking about. Lucy continued with last-minute preparations for the food she was going to take around to my house, and wouldn't say any more except for a beautifully delivered, "You know very well what I'm talking about." That was all the kids wanted to hear, or rather all they didn't want to hear. Hell, if one of their own parents wouldn't verbalize the danger, then it was clearly something out of the ordinary. It was like being knocked down by a car if you didn't look when you crossed a busy road, or falling off a wall if you insisted on walking, or out of a tall tree if you insisted on climbing. This was something else, something evil, something that existed in the shadowy area which adults can't even bring themselves to talk about in front of their kids. In short, it was creatures with partly decomposed bodies who snuck into your house and lay under your bed until you needed to take a pee so badly that you thought your bladder would explode. Wart-faced old crones who made stews of kids' eyeballs, and long-toothed men in swirling cloaks who could drink your body dry of fluids in the time it took to click your fingers. Then the telephone rang, and while all six of the kids watched, still coming to terms with Lucy's obvious concerns, Sam picked up the phone and, after a couple of minutes, launched into a blazing temper with whoever it was on the other end of the line. It was Sam's boss. Actually, it was Nikki calling from my house, and the word was that Sam was needed right now to go through some papers that had to be amended for Monday morning's board meeting. "Can't this wait for tomorrow, for God's sakes?" Sam asked. Apparently not. And even his explanation of the event we'd planned fell on the stony corporate ears of the boss. Sam slammed the phone on the cradle, explaining he'd have to go out for a couple of hours to get this thing sorted out, but he'd be back in time to eat. Phil and I would have to take the kids by ourselves. Sam left the house in a stinker of a bad mood, slamming the door so hard behind him that one of the inlaid glass panels cracked from top to bottom. Believe me, De Niro could learn a lot from Sam Hay. As Sam's car engine burst into life outside, Phil and I held a muted conversation with Lucy, muted but anxiously watched and listened to by our six charges, and then, putting on a brave face, we loaded them into the car and set off for the woods. The second part of the plan was underway. And Sam, complete with appropriate costumery and props, was already a couple of miles ahead of us. When we reached the prearranged pull-in, what had started out as the worst night of the year soon blossomed into the worst night since the last dinosaur had walked the planet. The moon hid itself behind thick gray clouds scudding across the sky like stock car racers. Rain was coming down almost horizontally in the wind, and somewhere off in the distance, muted thunder rolled and crashed angrily while lightning forked to the ground. The setting was perfect. Right in front of us and stretching for more than a mile in any direction was the woods, a thick and frequently impenetrable collection of fir trees whose centuries of fallen pine needles had turned the ground and the simple overgrown path into a spongy blanket. The kids were less than happy at the prospect of venturing into the woods, but fatherly bravado won the day, and all of us suitably, if reluctantly, decked out in coats and jackets, our hair slicked back by rain and our hands feeling like they got frostbite, we set off on the path to the Old Clearing, which, as we explained, had once been a meeting place for witches of Harrogate and nearby Knaresborough. And wouldn't you know it, as we came within earshot of this clearing, we could hear hammering and frantic muttering. One or two of our charges wanted to go back, and Phil and I were in two minds whether to continue, wondering if what we were doing constituted mental abuse. But we pressed on amidst frantic shushes and hissed instructions from the children. Dropping to our hands and knees, we crept up to a vantage point where we could see into the clearing. The sight was pretty impressive, I have to say. There before us was a small cloaked figure hanging what appeared to be skulls by the light of a small lantern onto a makeshift trellis. It was muttering to itself, its tall conical hat sloping forward each time it stooped to retrieve one of the small skulls and proceeded to nail it into place. Then, suddenly, it stopped and looked around. Looked in whispered to Phil that maybe we should head for home. We stood up, ensuring that the twig was snapped in the process, and the cloaked figure screeched at the top of his voice and started running at us, its hammer at the ready. Phil and I and the kids, all of us screaming in blind terror, and I have to say at this point, not one of us was putting it on, turned and ran like hell back down the trail with the creature in hot pursuit. Back in the car, it was very difficult to calm the children and show that the figure was indeed none other than Sam, now chuckling to himself as he approached, removing his hat and pulling off the most evil-looking witch's face mask I have ever seen. After a violent but hysterical session of parent beating, wholly deserved, I have to say, we set off back to the house, first dropping Sam at his carefully concealed car so that he could make his own way. Watching the kids, in front of the reassuring glow of an open fire, telling their stories to their mothers and Nana, who, having wandered down into the main house to welcome us all home, was clearly relieved that we hadn't been murdered by witches, this telling was something to behold, their voices gaining in volume as each tried to outdo the others and explain just how horrible it truly was. And perhaps best of all, there was also our own voices, Phil's, Sam's, and mine, equally excited, trying to get across that magical feeling of stark terror, the feeling that we tend to lose as the call of adulthood overtakes so many of us without even realizing that it's disappeared, and despite our personal promises to ourselves that it never will. There followed a wonderful meal, some carefully chosen black and white movies on video, The Thing, Shades of Carpenter's Halloween, as I recall, and The Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and then the children went off to bed, exhausted but still excited, while the storm raged outside, seemingly trying to tear the house apart to get at the hoaxsters within. Needless to say, bedroom doors, our own included, were left ajar to admit as much light as possible from the corridor. Over time, particularly since Ollie and Tim moved to London a few years ago, the house has assumed even greater proportions. And it'll be worse this year. My mother died a few weeks ago as I write this, following a brief but spunky flight against the real monsters of the night, cancer. But every time Halloween comes along and the air gets smoky, Nikki and I hollow out our pumpkin and light it just for the two of us. And although I've never returned to the woods, at least dark, I always take a walk outside and look up into the night sky, forever whittling at the imagination in an attempt to make something sharp and deliciously nasty out of it. After all, it's the exotic monsters that make us forget the real ones. And driving past the cemetery gates on the morning of November 1st and seeing the graves undisturbed for another year is still a good feeling. Long may it remain so.
By the 1800s, upper and middle class Victorian Americans thought of Halloween as a quaint holiday brought to America by genteel English. This seems to have been the result of the popular fiction and articles in children's and ladies' periodicals of the day. They downplayed Irish Catholic connections and provided social tips on entertaining. Although they also downplayed death and magic, they reveled in divination, especially that involving romance. Parlor games such as bobbing for apples, jumping over candlesticks and the like, and Halloween parties were intended for Victorian adults, not children. Halloween was seen as an occasion for matchmaking more than fright. Ghost stories in the ladies' magazines became less involved with ghosts and more inclined to be tales of love with mildly gothic trappings. By the beginning of the 20th century, middle-class Halloween became more of a children's holiday full of harmless amusements. Parties, scavenger hunts, and other games became the focus. Scary and eerie elements were sanitized into safe, folkloric fun. Perhaps this is why author Christine Catherine Rusch expresses disappointment about Halloween. Her favorite Halloween memory is told to us by Kathy Osman.
Halloween has always been the most disappointing holiday for me. I feel as if the holiday has consistently promised and failed to deliver. Oh, there were highlights. When I was really, really little, younger than 7, perhaps as young as 4, my father had a colleague who devised a haunted house in his garage. At the time, my father worked at an exclusive college in Iowa, and most everyone connected with that college had money. This house was at the end of a long lane filled with trees, and the house was huge. The haunted house had the typical stuff: peeled grape eyeballs, cold spaghetti intestines, and lots of teenagers jumping out of the shadows and saying, "Boo!" But I had never experienced anything like it before. These people gave out a prize for best costume. But we didn't find out until we kids compared notes the next day that we all got best costume prizes. By then, it didn't matter. Only that puff of importance that had come at the moment of the prize, and the wonderful feeling that someone had noticed. Just after my 7th birthday in June, we moved to northern Wisconsin. Planning for Halloween was still important. I remember many costume discussions and begging, pleading, maybe even bribing my mother to sew me something special instead of buying the same store-bought items everyone else had. In those dark days, there were only a few mass-produced Halloween costumes. She never did, although once she got a neighbor to make me a princess costume. The year of the princess costume, when I was about 9 and becoming quite girly, was important because on October 28th, it snowed. Halloween dawned clear and cold, so cold that I had to wear my parka over my princess costume, and I had to wear boots instead of my pretty pink slippers. Even my cone-shaped hat with its long net veil had to be worn over a stocking cap. The weather turned all of us into flashers. Trick-or-treat was accompanied by requests from grown-ups to see our costumes, so we'd unzip the winter jackets, open them real fast, and close them again. No glamour, no scary looks, no nothing. Just candy tossed into our little pumpkin carriers. Candy and homemade caramel apples, and all kinds of forbidden Frito's products from the guy who lived 2 blocks over. He worked for Frito-Lay and got them for free. He was as cool as his next-door neighbor, the dentist, was uncool. That damn dentist gave out toothbrushes every year. Halloween got worse as I grew older. Some crazy idiot who lived half a block away from me put razor blades in apples, and fortunately we all found them before eating them. He got arrested. Most people stopped giving out really good goodies then. They settled for the prepackaged stuff, like candy bars, which all the parents inspected with magnifying glasses. You think I'm kidding, but I'm not. Before we could even touch them. And then there was the matter of belief. I don't know how old I was, maybe 10, but still in grade school, when one of my teachers decided to do Halloween in a big way. For the entire month of October, she had us study the origin of the holiday, read scary stories, perform poetry aloud, and prepare for our big Halloween party. The origin stories, about the fact that the ghouls and ghosties wandered the night only to disappear on November 1st, All Saints' Day, fired my imagination. I was convinced I'd see a ghost on Halloween. The poetry didn't help. That was the year we memorized The Cremation of Sam McGee by Robert Service, which was particularly appropriate because it was a story poem about being cold. In fact, the ghost of good old Sam, who freezes to death, is happy when his body is put into the furnace of that old barge. He says it's the first time he's been warm in months. Halloween in northern Wisconsin was always cold. Always. That snow from Princess year was common. It made trudging around in hopes of free candy a somewhat taxing experience. But the poems that really got to me were written by James Whitcomb Riley. He wrote a lot of funny, scary poetry suited to kids. And the most memorable, even for me now, is one called The goblins will get you if you don't watch out. By October 29th of that year, I felt a lot like the cowardly lion. I do believe in spooks. I do believe in spooks. But unlike my long-tailed friend, I wasn't afraid of those spooks. I wanted to see one. Banshees, goblins, wee beasties. I wanted to see them all. And in the nice, safe way that the holiday promised. They'd be there on All Hallows' Eve, and they'd be gone by morning. Well, that year we had our Halloween party. There was fog in our classroom, but it was caused by dry ice. There were monsters, but they were only teachers in costume. And there were flying ghosts, but they were only sheets bunched up and tied with rubber bands. So I had hoped that I might see something when I trick-or-treated. I trudged out into the snow, dressed like a belly dancer this time, a costume I borrowed from the university's theater department, a parka covering my bare arms and midriff, and the same damn boots digging through the snow. There were other ghosts and goblins and monsters with plastic faces, all wearing parkas and carrying little pumpkin baskets. And there were some big kids who, rumor had it, were going to beat up on all us little kids. Not to mention that crazy apple guy who had gotten out of jail and whose house was lit up like an orange and black Christmas tree. Parents hurried us by that place. In the nearby park that night, two teenage girls got raped. And near the high school, a man got sprayed with mace, although I never did learn why. The Frito guy had moved, leaving only the dentist. And then, as we were halfway through our trudge, it started to snow. Big, wet flakes that soaked through the parka onto my bare skin. A month-long buildup, and nothing. After that, I constantly found myself searching for the monsters. I wanted to see a ghost. I liked being scared in a safe environment. I started reading collections, like Alfred Hitchcock's Stories to Read with the Lights On, aptly named, and watching cheesy movies of the week, which in those days were mostly about Satan taking over girls' schools, or the devil taking over a town, or Beelzebub taking over the world's elite. The books and movies provided some scary moments, but they were clearly fiction. I read gothics, too, and tried to be all wispy and passive in hopes that some dark, brooding hero would take me to a moor, whatever that was, so that I could be mistress of his haunted house. As I got older and gave up trick-or-treating, I went to haunted houses, first sponsored by the school, then by a local radio station, and then by some commercial outfit that specialized in them for a while. Sure, the haunted houses had scary moments, things brushing your face in the dark, big menacing creatures jumping out at you, fake spiders falling on your head. But those were gotcha moments. I was searching for the real thing, a real haunt, a real spook, a real ghost. I never found it. Not on Halloween, anyway. Years later, at the moment my grandmother died, I thought I felt her brush my cheek. My father, after death, haunted me in nightmares for nearly a year. And for 6 months after one of my cats died, I would see her curled up in her usual places. Another of my cats saw her, too, and his hackles would rise every time. Then he'd go sniff the spot, always walking around the curved body of the ghost cat. As I've gotten older, I've come to realize that there are things in this world that we can't explain. Moments when the hair rises on the back of your neck for no discernible reason. Moments when a puff of cold air is menacing. Those moments can't be called upon at will, and few people will believe you when you say that you've experienced one. In that way, Halloween is still a cheat to me. A month of buildup that ends in laughter and candy instead of good-natured thrills and chills. But Halloween is different now. No children come to my door, even though I dutifully buy candy every year. They trick-or-treat at the mall, in the safe confines of a well-lit environment, parents and grown-ups watching their every move. Because the monsters did start to come out on Halloween, right toward the end of my trick-or-treat days. The razor blade guy in my neighborhood was a copycat. There had been a number of razor blade incidents in larger cities just the year before. Children were getting snatched on Halloween, or beaten, or worse. Those horrors were just beginning, and over time, the simple innocence of begging door to door became as scary a prospect for parents as taking a child to a drug-infested park and leaving him there. Those weren't the kinds of frights I wanted on Halloween. I wanted a white, see-through face to pop up in an upstairs window, a shimmery, shadowy shape to appear in a dark corridor. I wanted to see a corpse sit up in a barge on Lake Lafarge and be thankful to be warm. I wanted to outrun those goblins that were going to get me if I didn't watch out.
Among the lower classes, however, Halloween remained a night of rough mischief. It became an increasingly destructive way for poor city dwellers to vent their frustrations. By the 1920s, vandalism was no longer confined to tipping over outhouses and soaping windows. Severe property damage, fires, and cruelty to animals and people became all too common. Local civic groups mobilized to deal with what they called the Halloween problem. Various charitable and community activities were organized with young participants treated to parties as a reward. Children were encouraged to go door to door and receive treats instead of making trouble. By the 1930s, these beggars' nights were practiced all over the country. The trick-or-treat greeting first appeared in print in 1939. But vandalism and destruction, particularly in crowded urban areas, continued to grow throughout the 30s. In our final favorite Halloween memory, author Rick Howdala shares with us a prankster's view of Halloween's past. Ted Pfister tells us this Halloween remembrance entitled Nicknames.
Times have changed. Kids don't use nicknames the way my friends and I did when we were growing up. At least it seems that way. When I was a kid living in Rockport, Massachusetts, just about everyone had a nickname. There was Skippy Cunnilips Monroe. Skippy was a nickname for Sanford, so he got double duty. Ronnie Deadeyes Emerson, later immortalized as the name of my son Aaron's first rock band. Bob Mustard McIsaac. Bill Dimesworth Williams. Phil Cat DeGagna. Dana Dots Johnson, Mike Grass Powers, which had also been his father's nickname, so he was Little Grass and his father was Big Grass, and so many others. It seemed as though you weren't really in unless you had some kind of a nickname. Mine, as was my brother's, was the family unimaginative but serviceable Howdy, usually pronounced Howdy. Another thing that there seems to be fewer of these days is what we call local characters. You know, the town drunk, the village idiot, the gimp or crippled kid who had probably been stricken with childhood polio or something even worse. In these PC times, such characters don't seem to be around as much, and they certainly don't have the social status they once had. Everyone's been mainstreamed, and we certainly don't call people drunks and retards and cripples anymore. We were heartless and unenlightened back then, and often cruel in our nicknames and characterizations of people. One of the village nuts in our little town was a guy named Johnny Caffery. He'd just about stop anyone on the street and ask if they wanted to hear his chicken imitation. Whether they wanted to or not, he would immediately begin to cackle and flap his arms around. We had other town tards, notably Saf Stevens. But Johnny was the best, the most versatile and visible, even though he made me and my friends feel really uncomfortable whenever he was around. We were always afraid he might flip out or something. We didn't know better. That was one of the functions, for want of a better word, of these oddballs and misfits, to strike a bit of fear and wonder into all of us who thought we were normal. There but for the grace of God. We didn't know then what we know now, that normal is a relative term. Back then, it was an absolute. The scariest guys in town, though, were the town drunks. Some were stonecutters from the local quarries, which were still in business, but most of them, it seemed, were the fishermen and lobstermen from the wharves, a place my mother told me to avoid, so naturally I went down there often. I'm not sure why or how our town qualified to have so many notable town drunks. Maybe it's simply because we were a coastal community, and fishing and lobstering are damned hard jobs that call for extreme measures when looking for an outlet, or, as folks call it, blowing the stink off. Sure, there are still plenty of alcoholics in every town. The problem is, most of them are doctors and lawyers. But like I said, times have changed, and there no longer seem to be groups of men who hang around the wharves or stagger through town loaded to the gills, ranting and cursing at, well, practically everyone, including the local cops who either drove them home or carted them off to the tank to sleep it off. The town drunks all had their nicknames, too. There was Peanut, Honey, Mickles, Hobble, Chick, and plenty of others. You'll notice that I don't use their legal names because I didn't know them. They were adults, and I was just a kid. I don't use their last names because I don't want to hear from their surviving relatives' lawyers. All of the town drunks are long since dead, mostly from alcohol-related diseases, accidents, or in a few cases, suicide. Then again, drinking to excess is a form of prolonged suicide, just like smoking cigarettes. I'm not saying that I miss them. Well, yes, I am saying that I miss them. They added local color and humor and an element of danger to my childhood. They were basically harmless fellows, I suppose, but we kids were scared to death of them, terrified, in fact. The dangers ranged from foolish and laughable, like the boiling hot summer day when Mickles ranted and raved about the heat while he hosed down the outside of his house to cool it off inside, too dangerous and scary because we were positive if any of them ever caught us alone in the woods, they'd kill us, or worse. They presented us with a sense of real danger, and that's why I want to tell you about the Halloween night I had a life-threatening run-in with a couple of these old fellas. I live down in the country. Rockport was and still is a beautiful seacoast town, although there are now at least one, if not two or three houses between each house that was there when I was growing up. We have lost our baseball field, our sliding hill, and most of the woods we played in. But long before I was born, especially in the summer, artists and photographers would flock to Rockport like seagulls to the town dump before it became a sanitary landfill and reclamation area. My parents' house on Stockholm Avenue was in a really rural area known as Pigeon Cove, the part of Rockport that not many artists or tourists ever visited. We had dirt roads, cow and horse barns, chicken coops, old fishing sheds along the wharf, large fields and pastures, gardens, old sheds, and lots of woods and blueberry swamps and Indian caves to play in. When I was in grammar school, there were actually two brothers who occasionally rode the family mule to and from school, leaving him tied to the bicycle rack with some grass and a bucket of water during class. It was a wonderful bucolic life, especially in retrospect. Of course, on Halloween night, my friends and I would do the traditional stuff. We'd dress up in costumes. I favored Zorro if, besides a black mask, cape, and hat, Zorro favored blue jeans, a Rockport Little League t-shirt, and scuffed Keds sneakers. Go trick-or-treating and go to church or school-sponsored Halloween parties. Yes, we had a local church that held an annual Halloween party. Try getting away with that in these PC days. As we got older, we'd play more elaborate tricks, some of them so mean and dangerous that today they would easily garner a police record, if not actual jail time. I think I was in sixth grade when the following incident happened. I'd been out trick-or-treating with some friends, and we got the brilliant idea that it would be fun to bomb passing cars with the little green apples from some of the trees on our street. We hit the cars with snowballs in the winter, so what was the difference? Did I mention that we weren't the brightest batch of kids? Anyway, we hid in the shadows along the side of the road, armed with a handful or two of knobby, worm-eaten green apples as hard as small rocks. Whenever a car would go by, which wasn't very often, we would nail it, usually by bouncing an apple or two off the side panels or hubcaps if our aim was true. But I had the brainstorm that it'd be even better and funnier if we dropped the apples from the trees onto the passing vehicles. My friends weren't so sure about that one, so I was the only one who scrambled up into an old maple tree whose branches overhung the road. With my jeans pockets bulging with green apples, I was ready. It wasn't long before a car went by, and I timed it just right so the first apple I dropped, I didn't even have to wing it hard, hit the roof of the car with a resounding thump. The only proof that I had frightened the poor driver, and that was our intention, was a quick flicker of brake lights as he reacted to the sudden thump on the roof of his car. Satisfied, I watched the car continue down the road, the driver none the wiser that Zorro had struck. My ears prickled when I heard the approach of my next intended target. A loud sputtering and backfiring of exhaust filled the night. Looking up the old road, I saw an old pickup truck swaying around the corner by old man Nevela's house. My friends immediately scattered when they heard the raucous laughter and shouts of the passengers. They knew it was some of the local fisher and lobstermen returning from the wharves. Even at a distance, it was obvious that they had been celebrating Halloween and were drunk on their asses. But I wasn't worried. I was Zorro the Fox, dressed all, or mostly, in black, lurking above the road in the trees, hidden from them. I'm sure the palms of my hands were sweating as I gripped the green apples, preparing to throw. The headlights swung around the corner like prying searchlights as they momentarily swept aside the darkness along the roadside. I panicked, wondering if the light might illuminate me in the trees. But I felt safe. I was, after all, Zorro the Fox. My friends had long since vanished, scattering into the darkness as the truck rumbled toward my hiding spot. My friends knew not to mess with these guys, but I waited and waited, wanting to time my shots for maximum effect. I saw the dark silhouettes of several men in the bed of the pickup truck, swaying back and forth, laughing and shouting and waving their bottles around as they went. How long could someone do that these days without getting pulled over? I waited and waited until they were just about under my tree before releasing my barrage. Green apples rained down on the roof of the truck like huge hailstones, and I felt a rush of exhilaration when I realized that I scored several direct hits. It even looked like one apple bounced off the head of one of the guys in back. Oh, what happened next wasn't according to plan. I saw the bright red flash of brake lights and heard the harsh ripping skid of tires on the dirt-coated asphalt. That always happened when the driver reacted to the sudden thump of apples on the roof. That was my proof I had gotten them. Only this time the brake lights stayed on until the truck skidded sideways to a lurching stop. In a flash, the drunken lobstermen spilled out of the truck, cursing loudly as they scattered in all directions, trying to find the culprit or culprits who had the gall to nail them. I panicked, no longer feeling safe and invisible up in the tree, more like a treed raccoon. These guys were so raging mad and drunk that I knew they would kill me if they ever caught me. With my thin black Zorro cape flapping behind me, I fell as much as leaped out of the tree and landed in a rocky, overgrown field beside the road. One or more of the drunks must have seen me, and they started yelling as they gave chase. I'm positive that they were flinging curses at me, but I was too terrified at the time to recall precisely what they said, other than threatening to kill and skin me if they ever caught me. And I knew they'd do it, so I hit the ground running. I remember twisting my ankle on an unseen rock, but it wasn't enough to drop me or even slow me down much. The men from the pickup were after me, but they were so drunk they tripped and stumbled in the darkness while I lit out across Willow Johnson's pasture and into the bordering woods. I had the strength of my youthful legs and pure terror pushing me on. Besides, I was dressed like the knight, as Zorro, so I eluded them easily. Crouching in the woods, panting heavily and dripping with sweat in the chilled night air, I listened as the fisherman finally gave up, climbed back into the truck, and drove off. I had escaped with my life, but I knew that it might not be over yet. If any one of them had caught even a glimpse of me, I knew they would have recognized me. In the morning, a phone call to my father to report what I had done would earn me a whipping. Yes, this was back in the days when strappings and beltings were the common and accepted disciplinary punishment for me and all of my friends. I didn't get many. just enough. My fear of punishment made me behave, or at least make sure neither my parents nor any other adults ever caught me. There's not much more to tell. This is really just an incident from my life, not a story. But to this day, it remains vivid in my memory. I'm sure the fear I felt that Halloween night fuels some of the stories I write. And when I think about it, I miss the childlike innocence of those days. I wish I had a better memory. Maybe that's why I write fiction, to try to bring it all back. But there is one thing I do for sure, and that's encourage my kids to create and promote the use of nicknames among their friends. It's one of those little things that adds character to ordinary life. Happy Halloween!
Fall celebrations of life and death are common in most cultures. The way modern folks relate to the dead, the supernatural, their fears, and their futures has changed. For Americans, Halloween has manifested itself as an important, if still unofficial, holiday. As we progress through different stages in life, we relate to Halloween in different ways. The day comes when we are too old for trick-or-treat, but that may mean we're ready for more adult activities. Like the Victorians, young and single adults often mix the modern equivalent of matchmaking with Halloween celebration. As we become parents ourselves, we pass on traditions, give out the treats, and make the costumes. We become responsible for supplying some of the magic ourselves. At the same time, we discover that we still have a need to be, just for one night, something other than we usually are. Instead of becoming gatekeepers for a new generation, some adults extend the fantasy of Halloween far past the perimeters of age. Whatever its history, Halloween is anything but a dead tradition. It is, perhaps, more alive and more meaningful now than ever before. We hope you've enjoyed our program. October Dreams was produced for Houston Taping for the Blind by Robert Schuller, with production assistance from Jim Martinez and Justin Blunt. On behalf of all of the volunteers and staff at HTBR, Happy Halloween.